Trying to put it together here. I don't often do this, but Amy Goodman did an interview with Jimmy Carter about his book, Palestine, Peace or Apartheid. And you didn't hear about a glimmer of that here and there. And on the news hour, when it came up, when they were talking to some of Carter's colleagues, the interviewer, the Schifrin guy, the hack journalist that he is, I think, opinions you hear are those of the speakers, had to interrupt and say, of course, the Israelis deny that there's anything like apartheid. He shares Desmond Tutu's assessment, which is that the situation in Israel is worse than apartheid. And actually, I think Carter actually says that on this interview that was conducted a while back. So there we go. Also have the October surprise. I haven't even previewed. The son of the famous journalist Robert Perry, maybe you've heard of him. He should be more famous. He's the guy that broke the Iran-Contra scandal. He also did a full-length book called Trick or Treason about the hostage deal, the suggestion that perhaps the Reagan administration made a deal with the mullah at some level to end the hostage crisis. I remember it distinctly. I came back from my first trip to Europe on the inauguration day, the same day that the hostage is released. And at the time, it was talked about. And in fact, this interview with Robert Perry's son is from a couple of years ago. There had been actually a bit of discussion of it in the New York Times, where Bush, too, was defending his father in some way. All right. Talk Nation, I mentioned. I'll be sitting in for the first hour of the labor show because both of the labor educators are off doing their work. And the host, Bob Pelesny, prepared a hour segment of Gus Wood talking about black movies, black films. He's a erudite guy on all cultural stuff. I don't know how he does it. But Bob mashed together two episodes where he's talking about part one and part two on African-American filmmaking. Bob is getting some R&R down in, Memphis for Blues Challenge, where I think it's Midwestern. Bands from all over the Midwest gather to, maybe it's nationwide. I think it's Midwestern. I don't know. Yeah, there's an interesting conversation going on still in the other room. So let's hear what Amy's got. And she's got something on about another thing that Biden could do before the end of his term. And I hope he pardons commutes the sentence of Leonard Peltier, of course, but also Mumia Jamal, who I don't think has any fresh comments. He did an epitaph for Carter last week. So we're kicking it with Amy's commentary, and then we'll get to an underwriting announcement, I guess. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم ألم نشرح لك صدرك ووضعنا عنك
Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan, and our week. Biden has time and authority to finally close Guantanamo. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. The time has come to shutter the prison at the U.S. Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, where men are held far offshore the mainland U.S. in an extrajudicial hell. They're men imprisoned for over 20 years, without charge, without trial, and who've been cleared for release remain caged, virtually forgotten. President Biden, thankfully, hasn't forgotten. 11 long-term Guantanamo prisoners were recently released, transferred to Oman to live free. 15 men remain imprisoned in Guantanamo. Of those 15, six have never been charged with a crime. Three have been cleared for release. Biden can deliver a measure of justice to all those remaining in Guantanamo. He should release those who've been cleared and transfer those who remain charged or convicted to a facility inside the U.S. He should then order the notorious Guantanamo Bay prison to be shut down once and for all. Over 780 men were imprisoned at Guantanamo since 2002. Most without charge. A handful of U.S. attorneys have advocated for them, some for almost a quarter of a century. Ramzi Kassem, a law professor at City University of New York, is one of these lawyers.
Maaz al-Alwi is a Yemeni national.
Ramzi Kassem said on the Democracy Now! NewsHour, describing one of his clients who was just released to Oman.
He's one of the very first prisoners who arrived at Guantanamo almost. I mean, the prison was opened on January 11, 2002. He was on the second or the third plane. You could tell by his low internment serial number, 028. He was never charged with any crime. He was, like the majority of prisoners at Guantanamo, sold for a bounty, $5,000 to $15,000 that the U.S. government was paying to tribes in the Afghanistan-Pakistan border region for so-called Arabs out of place. And, you know, by the government's own allegations, Mr. al-Alwi never so much as fired a shot at U.S. forces or their allies. Still, he spent 23 years, over half of his life, at Guantanamo.
Ramzi Kassem described another of those prisoners recently released from Guantanamo.
Senator al-Kazemi survived the CIA black sites. He was disappeared in the United Arab Emirates. Survived severe forms of physical and psychological torture at a prison that the prisoners who survived it called the Prison of Darkness or the Dark Prison. The CIA called it the Salt Pit or Cobalt in the Senate's report about the torture that happened there. And he was brought to Guantanamo in 2004. He was also never charged with a crime. He has four kids that he hasn't seen for, you know, the better part of their lives.
Multiply these stories hundreds of times, and you begin to grasp the scale of injustice that's dominated the 20-plus-year stain of Guantanamo on the U.S. justice system. Sharkawi Al-Haj is another of the Yemeni prisoners just released to Oman. He's long been represented by Pardis Kabriai, a senior staff attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, or CCR.
Sharkawi is 51. He's been inside since, I think he was captured when he was 28, 29.
Kabriai said on Democracy Now!
Guantanamo was set up as a place it was an intelligence gathering operation. The point of it was to establish a place offshore where people could be held outside the bounds of the law without access to courts, incommunicado, and where they could be interrogated.
Despite years of interrogation, including 2 years before Guantanamo, when Sharkawi Al-Haj was imprisoned at a CIA dark site in Jordan and at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, which was dubbed Gitmo East, as the brutality inflicted on prisoners there paralleled that suffered at Guantanamo itself.
The release of these people and their freedom for the first time after all of this time, the chance to reunify with their families and begin to recover and rebuild is, you know, it's hard to overstate the enormity.
Said CCR attorney Pardis Kabriai. It seems at best unlikely that the remaining prisoners would see anything under the incoming Trump administration other than a continuation of their lives in the legal black hole that is Guantanamo Bay. For example, Moaf al-Alwi became an accomplished artist while imprisoned, following a 2017 New York exhibit of art by him and other Guantanamo prisoners. The first Trump administration declared their artwork government property, telling lawyers it would be destroyed. The policy was reversed under President Biden. Perhaps if Trump's federal budget-cutting duo of Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy were to consider Guantanamo, it would be closed. After all, the government spends $500 million a year keeping the prison and the court at Guantanamo open, now for just these 15 men. President Barack Obama pledged to close Guantanamo as far back as 2009, but failed to do so. President Biden still has the power to close it. He has the authority, and he still has the time. But does he have the will? I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan. Biden has time.
Biden has a little time. So, yeah. So Jimmy Carter wrote the book in the aughts, I guess it would have been. Palestine peace or apartheid. I mentioned Bob Perry and the October surprise. That actually didn't happen in October, but yeah. And then David Gibbs, a protege of Chomsky. They were at the same institution for a while before Chomsky retired to Brazil with his wife and is now in the last days. He actually did an interview with Chomsky, David Gibbs. He's vocal on the humanitarian lie about U.S. interventions, even in the Balkans, which is a heated discussion from the Clinton period. Zbigniew Brzezinski, we're going to visit with him, the idea that he didn't care about a few agitated Muslims, stirred up Muslims was the quote, I guess, that it was worth it to draw Russia, then the Soviet Union, into the Afghan trap. There's very little about this, even on AudioPort, the Pacifica program service that I could find. It took me a lot of doing. I had to go to Gibbs' website at Arizona State, I guess it might be, and then cross-reference back to the Flashpoint segment because it was an index to include that topic. So, yeah, that was my morning, and I haven't had any tea yet. So here is the archival recording. Actually, there's an interview that's contemporary that was aired yesterday, but the interview with Carter is archival, and this, in my mind, makes him an incredibly, exceptionally good ex-president, but he had a lot to atone for. That was a rap that Gus Woods gave a couple weeks, last week, I guess it was, that Carter has been so humanitarian because he may have had some guilt about some of the things, many of the things that happened. The episode about East Timor, I didn't actually finish listening. That was on a Democracy Now! Segment that aired yesterday as well. All right, but here's some stuff that's not in the corporate press. Don't call it mainstream because it doesn't really affect mainstream views, does it? Oh, well, let's do the underwriting announcement since it's a welcome to see you one. There seems to be some high school sports event. I'm oblivious to sports events except it's football, which I could talk about a couple hours on. Saw some buses from Gray Lake and some northern suburbs on my drive over. I'm wasting time here, and we got so much to put on. I'll put on some more of this if I don't get to it tomorrow. But this is worth hearing in its entirety.
This hour of programming is brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and Make It Champaign Urbana. Make It Champaign Urbana provides programs to assist new residents in getting connected to the community. You're invited to start discovering the area and find resources with the Champaign Welcome Crew. This community ambassador program connects newcomers to one of over 50 local ambassadors so you can get settled into your new home. For more information, visit makeitcu.com.
Now, as we continue our discussion of President Jimmy Carter's legacy, we look at his policies in the Middle East and North Africa, in particular Israel and Palestine. Thursday, during the funeral, President Carter's former advisor, Stuart Eisenstadt, praised Carter's work on facilitating the Camp David peace accords between Israel and Egypt in 78.
Jimmy Carter's most lasting achievement, and the one I think he was most proud of, was to bring the first peace to the Middle East through the greatest act of personal diplomacy in American history, the Camp David Accords. For 13 days and nights, he negotiated with Israel's Menachem Begin and Egypt's Anwar Sadat, personally drafting more than 20 peace proposals and shuttling them between the Israeli and Egyptian delegations. And he saved the agreement at the 11th hour, and it was the 11th hour, by appealing to Begin's love of his grandchildren. For the past 45 years, the Egypt-Israel peace treaty has never been violated and laid the foundation for the Abraham Accords.
The Abraham Accords are the bilateral normalization agreements between Israel and the United Arab Emirates and Israel and Bahrain, signed in 2020. In 2006...
Okay, we'll go to the interview, but since I've been trying to get the media, and I've even tried to get Amy Goodman to cover this, that the Camp David Accords, Israel has been asking for it to be amended, which is the Rafah border, the border between Gaza and Egypt. It's been under joint control, and the Israelis basically de facto have control of it now, and they actually want to amend the Camp David Accords to allow them to have full control of it. And there's no evidence, according to Haaretz, that the Israeli newspaper, that it was ever used significantly for any smuggling of weapons. It certainly was smuggling foods and goods, which, since the place was already undernourished before the genocidal starvation that's going on now. All right, here's Carter from the date that Amy cites right there.
Years after he left office, Jimmy Carter wrote a book called Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid, in which he compared Israel's treatment of Palestinians to South Africa's former racist regime. It was striking for a former U.S. president to use the words Palestine, let alone apartheid, in referring to the occupied territories. I went down to the Carter Center to speak with President Jimmy Carter about the controversy around his book and what he wanted the world to understand.
The word apartheid is exactly accurate. You know, this is an area that's occupied by two powers. They're now completely separated. The Palestinians can't even ride on the same roads that the Israelis have created or built in Palestinian territory. The Israelis never see a Palestinian except the Israeli soldiers. The Palestinians never see an Israeli except at a distance, except the Israeli soldiers. So within Palestinian territory, they're absolutely and totally separated, much worse than they were in South Africa, by the way. And the other thing is, the other definition of apartheid is one side dominates the other, and the Israelis completely dominate the life of the Palestinian people.
Why don't Americans know what you have seen?
Americans don't want to know, and many Israelis don't want to know what is going on inside Palestine. It's a terrible human rights persecution that is far transcends what any outsider would imagine. And there are powerful political forces in America that prevents any objective analysis of the problem in the Holy Land. I think it's accurate to say that not a single member of Congress with whom I'm familiar would possibly speak out and call for Israel to withdraw to their legal boundaries or to publicize the plight of the Palestinians, or even to call publicly and repeatedly for good faith peace talks. There hadn't been a day of peace talks now in more than 7 years. So this is a taboo subject. And I would say that if any member of Congress did speak out, as I've just described, they would probably not be back into Congress the next term.
President Jimmy Carter, to see that whole interview we did at the Carter Center, you can go to democracynow.org. For more on his legacy in the Middle East during his presidency and beyond, we're joined in London by historian Seth Anaziska, professor of Jewish-Muslim relations at University College London, author of Preventing Palestine, A Political History from Camp David to Oslo. What should we understand about the legacy of President Carter, Professor Anaziska?
Well, thank you, Amy. I think primarily the biggest lesson is that when he came into office, he was the first U.S. president to talk about the idea of a Palestinian homeland alongside his commitment to Israeli security. And that was an enormous change from what had come before and what's come since. And I think that the way we understand Carter's legacy should very much be oriented around the very deep commitment he had to justice and a resolution of the Palestinian question alongside his commitment to Israel, which derived very much from his Southern Baptist faith.
And talk about the whole trajectory. Talk about the Camp David Accords, for which he was hailed throughout the various funeral services this week and has been hailed in many places around the world.
Well, I think one of the biggest misunderstandings about the legacy of Camp David is that this is not at all what Carter had intended or had hoped for when he came into office. He actually had a much more comprehensive vision of peace in the Middle East that included a resolution of the Palestinian component, but also peace with Syria, with Jordan. And he came up with some of these ideas, developed them with Cyrus Vance, the Secretary of State, and Zbigniew Brzezinski, his National Security Advisor. And in developing those ideas, which came out in 1977 in a very closely held memo that was not widely shared inside the administration, he actually talked about return of refugees, he talked about the status of Jerusalem, and he desired very much to think about the different components of the regional settlement as part of an overall vision. This was in contrast to Henry Kissinger's attitude of piecemeal diplomacy that had preceded him in the aftermath of the 1973 war. So we can understand Carter in this way very much as a departure and somebody who understood the value and the necessity of contending with these much broader regional dynamics. Now, the reasons why this ended up with a far more limited but very significant bilateral peace treaty between Egypt and Israel had a lot to do both with the election of Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin in 1977, as well as the position of Egyptian President Anwar al-Sadat and also the role of the Palestinians and the PLO. But what people don't quite recall or understand is that Camp David and the agreement towards the peace treaty was in many ways a compromise, or in Brzezinski's view, was a real departure from what had been the intention. And that gap between what people had hoped for within the administration and what ended up emerging in 1979 with the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty also was tethered very much to the perpetuation of Palestinian statelessness. So if we want to understand why and how Palestinians have been deprived of sovereignty or remain stateless to this day, we have to go back to think about the impact of Camp David itself.
Interesting that Sadat would be assassinated years later in Egypt. When Carter was on the plane with Nixon and Ford, that's when they say that cemented his relationship with Ford, while they hardly talked to Nixon at all. But if you could also comment on President Carter and post-President Carter. I mean, the fact that he wrote this book, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid, using the word Palestine, using the word apartheid to refer to the occupied territories. I remember him chasing him down the hall at the Democratic Convention when he was supposed to speak. This was the Obama Democratic Convention. And it ended up he didn't speak. And I chased him and Rosalynn because—
Remember that in 1977— there was a very famous speech that he gave in Clinton, Massachusetts, talking about a Palestinian homeland. And that raised huge hackles, both in the American Jewish community, amongst American Jewish leaders who were very uncomfortable and were already distrustful of a Southern Democrat and his views on Israel, but also Cold War conservatives who were quite hawkish and felt that he was far too close to engaging with the Soviet Union. And so both of those constituencies were very, very opposed to his attitude and his approach on the Palestinian issue. And I think we can see echoes of that in how he then was treated after his presidency, when much of his activism and much of his engagement on the question of Palestine, to my view, derived from a sense of frustration and regret about what he was not able to achieve in the Camp David Accords. And his commitment stemmed from the same values that he had been shaped by early on, a sense of viewing the Palestinian issue through the same lens as civil rights and the same lens as what he experienced in the South, which is often what his biographers have explained, where his views and approach towards the Palestinians came from, but also a particularly close relationship to biblical views around Israel and Zionism, that he was very, very much committed to Israeli security as a result. And that was never something that he let go of, even if you look closely at his work in Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. Some of his views on Israel are actually quite closely aligned with positions that many in the Jewish community would feel comfortable with. The fact that people criticized and attacked him for that, I think, speaks to the taboo of talking about what's happening or what has happened in the context of Israel and Palestine in the same kind of language as disenfranchisement around a race in apartheid South Africa. And of course, as Carter said in the interview you just ran that you had done with him when the book came out, the situation is far worse in actuality with what is happening vis-a-vis Israel's treatment of Palestinians.
Seth Anasisco, I want to thank you so much for being with us, professor of Jewish-Muslim relations at University College London, author of Preventing Palestine, A Political History from Camp David to Oslo, speaking to us from London.
Indeed. Brzezinski wasn't that good of a chap. I think he opposed the Gulf War ones and twos because he thought it was tactically a bad thing to do, and it's been called a fiasco, the second one particularly, the big attack on Iraq by W. But he sort of set the stage, and some of that is in this discussion here with Professor David Gibbs at Arizona, colleague of Chomsky for the short time that Chomsky moved from Boston to, I guess it's Phoenix, I don't know where ASU is. This is an archival interview with Flashpoints, and it was a struggle to find it. It's not well talked about. And then we'll get to the possible deal that took Carter out of office that maybe he should have talked about, because it was talked about a bit, but you don't want to challenge the whole rotten system, do you?
Well, actually, as you point out, it started a bit before that. Maybe you could step back and talk a little bit about the history. When did the United States start mingling in the affairs of Afghanistan? When does this start? And then we're going to talk about Brzezinski.
Well, let me say at the outset that I've looked at a great deal of declassified U.S. government documents, also Soviet documents I've looked at as well. And what they show is that for most of the Cold War up until the early 70s, the Americans repeatedly, again and again, took the view that Afghanistan is of no strategic importance whatsoever to the United States. And the only strategic significance it has is that it borders the Soviet Union. The Soviets are very afraid of any destabilization on their borders. The Soviets take an interest in Afghanistan, but the United States has no interest at all in Afghanistan. And what changed, I should add, the Soviets have traditionally been a supplier of arms and economic aid to Afghanistan as part of their interest in keeping it stable on their frontiers. Again, this is from U.S. documents. What changed in 73-74 was the United States was facing the prospect of defeating Vietnam and feared that it was looking weak in Vietnam, and engaged in a series of covert operations designed just to project an image of power to our adversaries. One of them was Angola. The U.S. triggered a civil war in Angola, mostly just to show we could do it. And in Afghanistan, the United States triggered a series of tribal rebellions against the neutral government of Afghanistan in 73-74 in cooperation with Pakistan and Iran. As I mean, again, just as a projecting U.S. power, the U.S. had never, ever done this in Afghanistan before. So this was a real escalation. And again, it was just to make up for an image of weakness. In addition, the United States encouraged the Shah of Iran, with a lot of oil money, to replace the Soviet Union as the principal supplier of aid to Afghanistan. And that began to generalize destabilization of the country, leading to a communist takeover by the local Communist Party in 1978.
Yeah. Now, everybody thinks, including me until a little bit ago, that it was the Soviet invasion into Afghanistan that preceded the United States getting involved, supposedly, to a continuous fight against the Cold War. That's not how it happened, is it?
No, it's not. We now know a lot about it because, again, the declassification of documents that have become available and also statements by former officials. And what happened is that after the local Communist Party took over, by the way, without any Soviet support, we now know the Soviets never liked the Afghan Communist Party, didn't have confidence in it, and did not initially support its takeover. However, once they were in power, they engaged in a lot of rash decisions that alienated the population and produced an insurgency by Islamic rebels in Afghanistan, known collectively as the Mujahideen guerrillas, the freedom fighters. I guess the term Mujahideen means holy warriors. You know, he began essentially having a civil war in Afghanistan. The Soviets reluctantly began giving arms and training to the Afghan soldiers, but they refused to send regular combat troops because they could see the government they were supporting was a weak government. They did not want to get that involved. And we now know, again, from the records, and this is very different from what you were reading in the papers at the time, was that, again and again, the Afghan government kept begging the Soviets to send ground troops, and again, the Soviets refused, saying they just wouldn't do it. Well, a number of things changed that caused the Soviets to change their mind, but possibly one of the most important was that in July 1979, the Carter administration, at the insistence of Brzezinski, who was the National Security Advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, the United States began, through the CIA, giving what was called non-lethal military aid to the Mujahideen. Right? Now, this was a major escalation because, you know, the Soviets initially were fighting an indigenous rebellion, but not one aided by the United States. Now the United States had committed itself to some degree to the success of the Mujahideen. The Americans had to realize that the Soviets would find out about this, and they very likely did, and this increased their paranoia. And the paranoia of the Soviet Union is evident from the documents. And what the record shows was that in the period after this aid was given, the Soviets began to reevaluate their policy in Afghanistan and feared that the United States would set up bases in Afghanistan and use it as a means to threaten the Soviet Union itself on their borders. There's no evidence that the United States was going to go that far, but the Soviets feared they would increase their fears that the fact the United States was supporting the Mujahideen directly. All this was done in secret from the public. I don't think it was secret from the Soviets, but the public didn't know about it for many years. This led to the Soviet Union's decision to actually invade the country in late 1979 and have a 9-year occupation of Afghanistan, which ultimately ended in 1989. We know about the U.S. aid because, well, from a number of directions, there are a number of sources, but one of the most important is that Brzezinski much later gave an interview with a French magazine called Le Nouvel Observateur. Originally in French, I had it translated, in which Brzezinski boasts about the fact that not only did he push this aid, but he did it on the assumption it would lead to a Soviet invasion, and that he welcomed the invasion. And from the interview, there's a very strong implication that Brzezinski deliberately tried to provoke, and did provoke, the invasion, going directly against everything that was told to the public up till this time.
Wow. And he's, as you say, he wasn't ashamed to brag about it in public in this magazine. Maybe he didn't think French, most people in the United States don't speak a second language. Maybe he was hoping that that would be problematic. But it is so interesting to me, when I think about the war and the U.S. war in Afghanistan, I'm thinking about two politicians, George Bush II and his wife, you know, and I'm thinking about Brzezinski. And I'm thinking that in terms of Bush, there's a woman by the name of Nicole Wallace who helped write that cover-up policy for Bush 2. She has 2 hours a day on the network. And then there's Brzezinski's daughter, and she has 3 hours a day, that Cup of Joe, whatever they call that show. So here's five hours of prime time with people who have every reason to lie. And they haven't, you know, they're very righteous about Trump, but nothing said here about the roles that the people who their heroes played in this horrific situation, this chapter in U.S. occupations in Afghanistan. You want to talk about, does that concern you in terms of getting the information out?
Well, I wouldn't say it's a concern. It's an observation on my part that the American media, the mainstream media, has always seen itself quite openly and publicly as a kind of a cheerleader for U.S. foreign policy. You know, you have this thing called the foreign policy establishment, which is much broader than the government, a vast network of current and former officials, people in the private sector who supply things to the government, most notably weapons, ex-military, ex-CIA, and extends into things like think tanks, elite academia, and the media. There was a really wonderful article by Bernstein of called Bernstein of Watergate fame in the Rolling Stone, I think in 1977, called The CIA and the Media, that a significant part of the media is directly connected to the CIA. A large number of journalists had, you know, written agreements with the CIA where they were, agreed not to disclose their ties to the CIA. And the New York Times was especially integrated into this CIA network. And what's very striking about the present era is this is being done quite openly, and that's some of the principal commentators one sees. And things like CNN, MSNBC, a lot of these are former intelligence officers, and very openly former intelligence officers, presented without any suggestion that what they're saying might be suspect, given that intelligence agencies are trained to deceive. I mean, that's a basic part of one's training, where one becomes an intelligence officer is deception. And, that might raise some questions about the credibility of the claims. This is almost never addressed in the mainstream media. But it does reflect the fact that the media, and parts of academia are like this too, I hasten to add, are to some extent an extension, if not of the government, of the foreign policy establishment. And it partly accounts for why the United States has had so many wars, because there's always a tremendous lobby for wars and for keeping the wars going as long as possible. The biggest lament I'm seeing in much of the mainstream media isn't that so many Afghans were killed or that the decision to go to war was taken initially, but that the war is ending. The real mourning here, the real regret, is that the war is coming to an end after 20 years. And again, that reflects a real bias in the media. I think it's closely connected to the fact that there are so many former intelligence officers and generals who are, you know, the talking heads one sees on TV.
Professor Gibbs, a colleague of Chomsky, that's why there's so much media analysis there, I guess. That wasn't that long ago. I called it archival. It was from 21 on the occasion of the withdrawal from Afghanistan. but the segment I played was about the Brzezinski national security machinations under Carter, which I think he should probably have to atone for. Opinions you hear are those of the speakers, and now I won't be getting all of this on. It's a half-hour program called Talk Nation. Still going on. It's David Swanson, who's done some great work during the Iraq War. He had a website called After Downing Street when there was a revelation in the British press, not quite as well taken up here for the mentions that were just made. Oh, I should mention that Mint Press has a whole series of interpenetrations of the media by Israeli actors. Sounds conspiratorial? Well, they have pretty good documentation. Okay, here's Talk Nation Radio, and I haven't previewed this at all. It was on the occasion of the release of a book that collected Robert Perry's work, and it was only March of last year that this was recorded. But the issue about possible collusion between the Reagan campaign and the Iranians to make sure the hostages wouldn't be released until Inauguration Day, again, the day I came back from my first trip to Europe so many years ago, I guess that would be 1980 in January.
Welcome to Talk World Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. This week on Talk World Radio, we are discussing the October surprise and independent journalism with Nat Perry, who is an author, an independent journalist, and the editor of the recently published book, which I highly recommend, American Dispatches, a Robert Perry Reader, as well as the article at Consortium News, New York Times catches up to Perry, but still falls short on October surprise. Nat Perry, welcome to Talk World Radio.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Now, when you say catches up to Perry, which Perry are we talking about?
Yeah, well, I guess that is a little confusing, isn't it? But that's the headline that the editor, Joe Loria, went with. But yeah, I think he's referring to my dad, Robert Perry. I mean, he was the one that really, you know, blazed the trail on October surprise reporting.
For anyone who hasn't paid attention to the New York Times for a week or so and hasn't paid attention to Robert Perry for decades, would have been informed a little faster than waiting for the New York Times. What is the October surprise?
So basically, it refers to this controversy that arose from the 1980 presidential election, Ronald Reagan against Jimmy Carter. And at the time, of course, there was a hostage crisis in Tehran, Iran, following the Iranian Revolution of 1979. It was a major story for over a year, 52 American hostages being held at the U.S. Embassy in Tehran. And it was really the defining story of 79 and 1980. And Jimmy Carter, of course, was working very hard to get these hostages freed, you know, holding meetings and conducting diplomacy to get the hostages freed. The October surprise, it's become kind of a common term in our vernacular, October surprise, but the first time that it was used was for this election in 1980. And what it was a fear in the Ronald Reagan campaign that Jimmy Carter would manage to get the hostages freed just before the election, which they feared would boost his re-election chances. So they were allegedly, I guess we should still say, working behind the scenes, the Ronald Reagan campaign, led by William Casey, who then became CIA director. They were working behind the scenes, meeting with the Iranians and promising them a better deal if they held the hostages there until Ronald Reagan was elected. So they felt that that would destroy Carter's re-election opportunities. And it seems that they were right. He never managed to get the hostages freed, and it pretty much sunk his re-election chances. So at that point, well, after the election, I mean, pretty much immediately, as far as I understand, there were sort of rumors that this had happened, and it kind of was a bit of a unspoken or open secret, I guess, in Washington. But then it really became known after the Iran-Contra affair broke, that my father kind of broke working for the Associated Press, And when they were looking into this during the congressional investigation in 87, they realized that the arms shipments to Iran they had their beginnings during the 1980. So the assumption was that it started in the mid 80s, but so people started looking into that again, and it kind of bubbled up into, you know, in the early 90s, there was some good journalism being done at the time. You know, it's kind of hard to imagine now, but you know, the mainstream media was really pursuing this story, especially Nightline. They had a really good documentary in June 1991, and it kind of was bubbling up at that time. And then the media, they kind of closed ranks. There were some stories published by the New Republic and Newsweek that sort of debunked or tried to debunk the story by claiming that William Casey couldn't have been in this key meeting in Madrid because he was at this conference in London. And but that alibi fell apart pretty easily. Then there was this congressional investigation, which also tried to debunk the whole story and kind of came up with a new alibi for William Casey. But those were also sort of debunked by my dad, who discovered this trove of secret documents that were part of the investigation, but were not included in the final report because they didn't support the official narrative. So in a nutshell, I guess that's the story. The New York Times has just kind of added a new wrinkle to it with a claim from this guy, Ben Barnes, who worked for John Connolly. And he claims now that he accompanied John Connolly on one of these visits to the Middle East to try to sabotage Carter's hostage negotiation.
So it seems to me, Nat Perry, that your dad, Robert Perry, documented this extensively, including with those documents from Congress decades ago. I've not had a glimmer of a doubt that this wasn't as well established as any other piece of history for decades. And now the New York Times has added the John Connolly's role to the story. It doesn't seem to alter the basic narrative very much, just or reconfirms it and adds another player. Why in the world do we still have to say allegedly? Explain to me, when is it that you say allegedly and when is it that you don't?
I don't know. I mean, in the article I just published at Consortium News, I did use allegedly, and I struggled with that question myself because, I mean, and this is why I do welcome this New York Times article, even though, I mean, they're sort of, they're still sort of playing games and they're sort of whitewashing the history a bit. And there's some complaints I would have about the article, but I mean, I think it helps, you know, to establish the reality that this did happen. And I think we really need to kind of move past that. And maybe I should be more careful as well when I talk about it or write about it, but, you know, maybe drop the allegedly, because I mean, the evidence is overwhelming. I mean, I think anyone who, and this goes back when I first started, you know, looking into this story when my dad was writing about it in the mid-90s, that's when I read his book, Trick or Treason, first, and then his follow-up work on the October Surprise X-Files, these documents that were, classified that didn't support the narrative, so the congressional investigation sort of put them in a box and tried to hide them away. And anyway, but even back then, it was, I think any reasonable person looking at the evidence, you know, you have to conclude that this happened. And the thing is, like, in the early 90s, that was kind of where it was going, you know. And if you go back to that, there's this really good Nightline documentary in June 1991, which is available on YouTube. Just watch that at that time, because there was a sort of open inquiry at that time. But then they sort of closed ranks. And then that congressional investigation just established the conventional wisdom. And the New York Times also participated in that because they gave Lee Hamilton, who led the congressional investigation, space on their op-ed page. And he published an op-ed called Case Closed. And relying on these bogus alibis for William Casey and others sort of to establish, you know, that this is the official story. And that's when it became really toxic, radioactive, and made it very difficult for journalists like my dad to continue covering it. Anyone who did, you know, their career suffered. And this is also, I mean, this is why, actually, because of the stories, why he launched Consortium News in the first place, because he had access to all these documents and no one was interested. You know, by the mid 90s, it was just like, it was just shut down. There's no space for real journalism on this. So he started this independent media project to create a home for this kind of journalism. So it's good to see the New York Times finally catching up. And they did give my dad a bit of credit. They referenced one of his articles. They could have referenced a lot more, honestly, because that was just sort of one aspect of the story that they gave him credit for. But you know, at least they did that. And they did some good journalism there, too. I mean, the reporter Peter Baker sort of confirmed Ben Barnes' story that John Connolly, they went to the Lyndon Baines Johnson Library and they found some documents that confirmed, they found Connolly's itinerary from that period in, I think it was June 1980, and showed that he did go to these countries that Ben Barnes claims he went to. So, you know, yeah. So it just adds a little to this, to the narrative, I think. It just kind of gives a little more context that it looks like Ben Barnes went first, and then there were follow-up visits by William Pace. And then in October, Connolly, and this is something my dad reported on years ago, that he had heard rumors from the Middle East that Carter was about to achieve his objective in getting the hostages free. And that was October, just a few weeks before, or maybe just a week before the election or something like that. And that's when Casey allegedly or not so allegedly went to Madrid for this final meeting. That, and basically what they did was they just offered the Iranians more weapons, better weapons, whatever, cheaper, just it's all about weapons. They were giving, and this is another aspect. So they, not only were they keeping these hostages in this situation for, several months longer than they should have been, but they were arming Iran, who, was a sworn enemy and designated as an enemy by the United States government. So it really just kind of shows how much, what they're willing to do, to achieve their objectives. And, so that's also why I think it's so important for the Washington establishment to just try to squash the story as much as possible.
So Nat Perry, what will happen now with this story? I mean, the New York Times seems to have flipped from decades ago saying the case closed, we need to bury this conspiracy nutty theory once and for all, to it happened and we've been the ones to figure out how to prove it happened, and we still denounce the evidence that others came up with, that we ignore that Casey took certain trips, but we do report on what Connolly did, and that Connolly reported to Casey, and that they did it, and that, as you say, the Republicans engaged in the highest level of cynicism, giving weapons to their sworn enemies, keeping U.S. hostages hostage longer, and so forth. Will that become common knowledge, accepted history? Will it go in the textbooks that the Republican legislatures are revising? Will every story that mentions that period of time and that election refer to it as understood wisdom? Or will we go on saying allegedly from here on out?
Well, no, it's a good question. I guess only time will tell, but I mean, I think we've always sort of been, it's always been very close to, an accepted history. I mean, I remember even when I was in, as a history undergrad at George Mason University, I remember reading a book at that time, the mid 90s, and just one of the textbooks that was assigned by my professor, and it kind of mentioned something about it. I remember telling my dad that it cited his book Trick or Treason, and but I think it said something like it should be taken with a grain of salt, but there is some evidence pointing to this conspiracy or whatever. So I think it's always been kind of, somewhat close to that, and so hopefully this New York Times article kind of just removes any of the lingering doubts. And like you say, I mean, it really should be the accepted narrative, but I think, it's clear what they're doing, though. At the same time, I mean, if you read their article closely, it's kind of covering, Congress and their own, and the New York Times' own ass, because they're basically, the article said that this, what makes the Barnes claims new is that he's not like one of these shady arms dealers, so it kind of denigrates the sources, and ignores many of the other very credible sources. But some of them were arms dealers, because this is a story about arms.
Who's going to know about arms dealing if not arms dealers?
So they kind of, but So I think that's what they're doing. They're trying to make it acceptable. And it looks like Carter's about to pass away. He's in hospice care. And that's what motivated Barnes to come forward, I think, is that he doesn't want to see, you know, all the these segments we're going to see on TV whenever, you know, whenever Carter passes away. Because this is a big part of his legacy, you know? I mean, it's, you know, we're going to see these retrospective, you know, segments on in the media. And I think that's what sort of motivates Barnes at this point to try to correct the record. And so we'll see. I mean, I think it'll be interesting to see, you know, whenever Carter does pass away, see how they handle this. But I did notice, I said there was actually a very good documentary on, I think it was Netflix or maybe HBO recently about the hostage crisis. And it handled everything very well. I mean, I learned a lot from it. I mean, just sort of, you know, what happened in 1979 and, you know, how they ended up taking over the embassy and all that. But then they just totally skirted the whole question of the negotiations and, you know, avoided the, you know, the October surprise controversy. But
yeah,
I don't know. We'll see. I mean, yeah, only time will tell. I mean, the New York Times, you know, for whatever reason, it still carries a lot of weight. You know, I think a lot of it's sort of undeserved credibility in some ways, but, you know, that's still the paper of record, I guess. So, you know, if they're now saying it's that it really happened, then maybe that'll be the new narrative.
Understatement of the day, I think, New York Times undeserved credibility. The October surprise is just one of many stories in this book, Nat Perry, that you've edited called American Dispatches, a Robert Perry Reader. There we go. Yeah. If you're watching our video, you can see the book there. Can you give us a few hints of some of the other stories? Some of them, I think, follow the saga of the deals made with Iran and the Contras and the CIA and the cocaine, all of which I think makes better sense in if pieces aren't left out of the story, as has been the norm, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. It was sort of what motivated me to first start collecting these articles. And, you know, I had this idea a few years ago because I realized, like, I had never really read a lot of the articles my dad wrote, like the ones that really kind of, when he was breaking these important stories in the 1980s, I was a child at that time. I didn't really start reading his work until, you know, the mid-90s. I personally wanted to go back and, you know, read these articles. So, it starts when he was a student journalist in the early 1970s. So the first article was from May Day, 1970. He was arrested in D.C. with thousands of other anti-war demonstrators and follows his work, you know, as a beat reporter in the 70s and then into the 80s when he was assigned to the investigative unit at the Associated Press. And, you know, he started looking into following the Reagan administration's Central America policy mostly. And so covered all these, you know, atrocities in Central America, like the El Mozote massacre and in El Salvador and the Contra War. In Nicaragua, but his big, you know, break was really when he uncovered the Contra cocaine trafficking and tied that to the Central Intelligence Agency. And there's also an early story from the 80s of the CIA mining the harbors of Nicaragua. And you know, some big stories there. And then the Iran-Contra story, of course, he was the first one to write about Oliver North's operation in the White House. They had all kinds of operations to try to. So when Congress prohibited aid to the Contras because of all these atrocities they were committing, the Reagan administration found all sorts of ways to kind of work around the ban on aid. And one of those ways was by diverting funds from arms sales to Iran to the Nicaraguan Contras. So he, you know, was the first to write about that, and you know, followed his work through the 90s and when he kind of decided to sort of break with mainstream journalism and start his own independent media project, mainly because of this, as I said, the October surprise story that no one was interested in at that point. But it follows all the way through the 2000s, the Bush years and Obama, and yeah, all the way into the Trump years when he passed away in early 2018. So from 1970 to 2018. So yeah, it's pretty comprehensive. I mean, the challenge was like really deciding what to edit and how much, because there's so much good material. It could have been a 10 or 20 volume set, really, if I included everything, but I wanted to keep it somewhat readable. So
I think you did an excellent job. And it occurs to me that Reagan and some of the people working with him were just infinitely cynical, as we've described. I think maybe Oliver North was a true believer. I mean, 1986-7, I was going to high school with Oliver North's daughter in Herndon High School in Virginia, and he came in and talked to our class about how close the commies were in Nicaragua, and why our teachers didn't have us properly scared, and so forth. So, I mean, some of these people believe this stuff, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is also what's occurred to me pondering this New York Times article on October Surprise and kind of, revisiting this 1980, how this all started with the Reagan era. That really brought the neocons, it gave them this huge platform. And I mean, before that, the neocons were just, this sort of obscure, intellectual movement, I guess. And I mean, it was really during the Reagan years where all these people like Elliot Abrams and Oliver North, they're very ideological, ideologically driven, true believers, as you say. And one thing that's also interesting, going back and reading some of my dad's early work in the early 1980s, because one of the articles included in their Reader is about how a lot of the foreign policy advisors that Reagan was bringing in, they were veterans of the Vietnam War, and they felt that, the U.S. should have wanted Vietnam. So they wanted to have another chance, to win the Cold War. And I mean, so they really were true believers. I mean, some of the most, extreme kind of neocons. And, and if you look at kind of the past 40 years, I think they've just become, more and more mainstream. And kind of just have taken over both parties with this sort of.
I think in Grenada and Panama and then the Gulf War, these were all attempts to cure us of the Vietnam syndrome, right?
That's right. Yeah.
The illness of opposing mass murder. They want to cure us of that, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the things my dad always highlighted, about the Persian Gulf War, the first Iraq War, was the first thing that George Bush said when that war was over was, by God, we kicked the Vietnam syndrome once and for all. And I mean, I think that it really goes a long way to show like what their motivations were in some ways, because,
That's Robert Perry's son, and I think it's James, and the host of Talk Nation. And it's on SoundCloud, which isn't the most searchable place to find it as far as the direct website. David Swanson. Still going on. He called it Talk World. And you can go to Consortium News and look for Perry's writings, his original 8-part series was called October Surprise X-Files. Bill Casey's Iranian Trip. Saddam's Green Light, Where's Bill Casey? Lies Spun into History was the concluding one. How Absurd Alibis Became Part of the October Surprise Historical Record. So there was a mention in there by the son of Perry that wondering how, when Carter died, that what reaction there would be. Well, to my mind, and if any listeners have seen any mention of this controversy, let me know. Because there's been zilch, which is why I played that in its entirety. Well, you can find it. It's not that dated. It's actually from last March. That's when this comprehensive book form of, not entirely comprehensive, because it could be of 9 volumes, as he said, of Perry's writing. We sure did miss him. He died with a mysterious cancer. Hate when that happens. Okay, underwriting announcement, and then we're going to hear a segment from Law and Disorder Radio that they packaged up for the holiday season. Labor Hour, Radio Free Labor is on holiday a bit. I guess the two university labor educators, Stephanie Furtado and Gus Woods, are outdoing that education. And on the occasion of that absence, their absence, Bob Pelesny is down enjoying blues and Memphis.